Hey there, SLP. You are listening to this podcast, so I know that you love to listen to podcasts. And if that is the case, then I know that you are going to love my secret private podcast, Secondary Secrets for SLPs. Its 6 short episodes will have you walking away feeling refreshed and inspired and ready to take on those challenging secondary speech students. So if you work with grades 4 through 12, and are in a planning rut or wanting some fresh new ideas to keep your students motivated, make sure you head to speechtimefun.com/secondary-secrets. You are not going to find this podcast in your iTunes podcast search browser. You can only get access by going to that link. So head to it now. It is 6 short episodes that you can listen to it in under an hour, like totally Netflix binge-worthy. I made this just for you, and I know you are going to love it. SLPs have been telling me already that it has changed their way for working with their older speech students. So head on over, again, to speechtimefun.com/secondary-secrets or use the link in the show notes, and I can't wait to hear what you think. Now let's head on to this week's episode of SLP Coffee Talk. Welcome to SLP Coffee Talk, the podcast designed exclusively for speech-language pathologists who work with older students, grades 4 through 12. I am your host, Hallie Sherman, your SLP behind Speech Time Fun, the Speech Retreat Conference, and the SLP Elevate membership. And I'm thrilled to bring you conversations, strategies, and insights that will give you the jolt of inspiration that you need. Whether you're tuning in during your morning commute, on a break in between sessions, or even during a well-deserved relaxation time, I am here for you each and every week. Let's do this, SLPs. Hey, hey, and welcome to another episode of SLP Coffee Talk. Today I have here Rachel, the PTSD SLP, and we're going to be talking all about trauma-informed care. So, Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been long overdue.
Seriously. I feel like we've talked about this so much, and finally it is here. So tell everyone who is maybe not familiar with you, or if they are and aren't, you know, we need a little refresher. Tell everyone a little bit about yourself and your journey here today.
Sure. So my name is Rachel. I am a speech pathologist in South Florida in the Fort Lauderdale area. I work for Broward County Public Schools, and I'm a speech program specialist. So I support all of the high schools in Broward County, which, for those of you not familiar with Broward County, it's the 6th largest district in the country. It's like 230,000 students. So I support 40 high schools and all the alternative centers, everything like that. I support the speech pathologists at those schools. So I really like the adult interactions that I have. Before that, worked in a high school in Broward County. So I still work for the same district that I worked in as an SLP. I worked for a school called Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, and I was there from 2016 to October 2021. And I am the PTSD SLP, as known on Instagram. The reason that I made that page is because I experienced a traumatic event at work. And through looking online for how to help myself who had gone through trauma, how to help my students who had gone through trauma, I Googled and I found trauma-informed care. And I realized at that time in 2018, speech pathology wasn't talking about trauma-informed care. And I realized that what I had been doing in my speech room with my students was trauma-informed, or how could I make it more trauma-informed? And not just for kids that I know what trauma they've gone through, how can I make my sessions trauma-informed for kids that I'm not going to know their background? So trauma-informed care has been what has brought me to this point, why I'm brought on to podcasts, why I'm here to talk to you. And it's been a passion of mine, and I love teaching on trauma-informed care.
Share a little bit more for those that might not be familiar. What falls under the scope of trauma-informed care? Like, or what is trauma? Like, is it just those that go through a large traumatic experience like you did? What falls under that scope?
I love that you're asking these questions. So one of the questions that I get, I do trainings all over the country now, which is like my favorite thing to do, of training SLPs, other related health professions, and educators. the question I always get is, what is trauma? A lot of people are trying to place in a box of, well, that's not traumatic, so you shouldn't feel that way, or that is traumatic and you should feel this way. My trauma is kind of considered a big T trauma. And when I talk in presentations about big T and little T trauma, I give it with the caveat of, here's this theory in trauma work, but I want you to throw it out. Because my position is saying, you don't need to know someone's trauma in order to be trauma informed. It doesn't matter if I've had a big T trauma or a little T trauma. Trauma is trauma for the individual. It's an individual's experience. There's a lot of things that go into making something traumatic or not traumatic. Or you might have, in my case, one event that happened with 3,000 people that are there at that time, who some of them might feel it was the most traumatic thing. And other people say, you know what? I don't consider it a trauma. And all of those people are completely valid in their reasoning for why. Did they have a support system? Did they get the help? And thankfully, because it was such a nationally known event, we did get a lot of help for the students, mental health professionals, community outreach. We had a lot of resources to help with the healing process, but not to necessarily prevent it from being a trauma. It was a traumatic event. And people who feel that it was traumatic, that is totally valid. What is trauma? What is not trauma? It's an individual's perspective of if it was traumatic for them. That being said, the word trauma is used way too much in our general vocabulary. Like, oh, I was traumatized because like my dog didn't listen to me or something like that. We need to be very mindful of when we are using these words, especially mental health words like I'm so OCD, I'm so crazy, I'm so bipolar, I'm so whatever, when we are not. Yeah, right. We're not really attaching them to the right thing. It's great that there's less stigma talking about these mental health terms, but it's also, we need to be very mindful of using them inappropriately.
That's such a great advice. You don't know what the client in front of you has been through. So what advice would you give to someone who, how are we supposed to know that we need to be giving them trauma-informed care if we're not aware? Like, I don't know about you, but oftentimes I'm the last person to know about a student's situation. Like all the teacher, the psychologist, everyone can know. No one would think to like inform me. Like, oh, I forgot that that student works with someone else. Or it's something that is just not disclosed.
Totally.
So what advice do you give to someone that how are we supposed to know?
Perfect. So trauma-informed care is a mindset. It is taking what's wrong with you, that phrase of what's wrong with that person, and changing it to what happened to you. And it's not what happened to you in the terms of I need to know what happened. Trauma-informed care is a blanket mindset that you should be using whether you know what they've gone through or not. So yes, I've been there as the SLP that I'm the last one to know that maybe the kid's family is going through a divorce or something. And you're like, oh, how long has this been going on for? And they're like, oh, several months. We've all known about it. And it's like, I could maybe have adjusted additional things. So that I would say trauma specific. There are trauma specific things that help you to address maybe the event that you know. So the specific trauma, whether they think divorce is a trauma or not, it might be traumatic for that kid. So that would be trauma specific. The whole concept of trauma-informed care is you don't need to be a trauma detective. You do not need to know what someone has gone through in order to be trauma-informed. So what is trauma-informed other than the what happened to you? It's a series of pillars. It's depending on what website you look, anywhere from 3 to 12 pillars, but usually it's safety, trust, collaboration, mutuality, transparency, and cultural, historical, and gender issues. So number one, safety. Safety is something that we as SLPs, we as providers can strive to give to our students without knowing what they've been through. The trauma specific stuff is what I would say. Once you know what a student has gone through, then you can say in your mind, how can I make it more trauma specific? How can I make it safer for this student? So one thing that I present on is the use of violent language. And these are just everyday things that we say. I can't tell you how many times a day, especially in my position in the district, that a traumatic event happened at a national level, I'm told, shoot me a text, shoot me an email. And then they look at me and they're like, oh, why did I feel so icky saying that to you? And they realize, they put the connection there, and they start realizing how many things in our vocabulary are like violent. And this term was given to me through someone that was attending one of my sessions, that violent language was given to her from her daughter who worked at a domestic violence clinic. That one of the rules working there and living there is you have to remove violent language, because the probability that all the people that are living there have gone through a violent event is very, very high. So when I have a classroom full of little speech kiddos, if I just have in my brain that the likelihood that they have experienced a traumatic event, or maybe I shouldn't use violent language in general because I'm not going to know who has experienced a violent event. Most likely, we're left out all the time. So if I just remove that kind of language from my vocabulary, I'm being more trauma-informed as a provider. You might find out specifics about what someone has gone through and you say, okay, how can I make sure that I adjust my language for this specific kid even further than just a blanket trauma-informed? But we should never, as SLPs, we don't need to be the trauma detectives of trying to investigate or figure out what has happened to that kid. It's more so a mindset. I look at my entire classroom as though they most likely have experienced trauma. How can I reduce my harm? That is a trauma-informed mindset.
That's such great advice. Oh my goodness. Removing the violent language and just treating everyone as if, like, you know, because you can't guess. And that probability also is so high, and especially because the scope of what falls under, you know, trauma, right, like you said. So it's such great advice. What other tips, other than making sure the language that you're utilizing, keep making sure they feel safe? What are some ways to make students feel safe and things like that, so that you can be more mindful of that?
So there's different components to safety. Safety is an emotional safety, a physical safety. And you might say, I hear it all the time in the school system, of a teacher saying, oh, I'm all my kids' safe person. Everyone feels that I'm so safe. I would change my mindset to say, there are probably kids that don't feel safe with me. How can I make them feel more safe? And it's listening to what their feedback is. So in my case at the school, the physical safety and emotional safety was harmed by a specific event. So when we have to go back to school and get back to learning and everything, and they come sit in my room and they're hyper alert, their brains are in survival mode, and I'm telling them, you guys are safe, you guys are safe, their brain is still telling them, it's not safe. You might be safe, but I don't care what you have to say. And that's their brain telling them, it doesn't matter what you're telling me, my body doesn't feel safe and my brain doesn't feel safe. So I can ask them, what would make you feel more safe in here with me? Is it that you want the windows up, you want the windows down, you want the door open, you want the door closed? Little things like that, or just seeing if they have a suggestion that you haven't thought of. And this not only applies to high schoolers, this applies to any age. This could be a three-year-old that's with you. What might make them feel more safe? Is it keeping the door open, keeping the door shut, or having a safe person in there, or a sibling in the room with you if it's a private practice kind of situation? Is there a stuffed animal that makes them feel safe? There are a bunch of things that you can ask the family of, what does make this kid feel more comfortable? So safety, we have to think of emotional, physical, and a whole kid concept of safety. What makes them feel safe? And it's not for you to say, well, that's a silly request, or I'm a safe person, so they should feel safe with me. That's not how that works. The individual is the judge of who is safe and who is not.
Now, would you use, especially with the older ones, would you use the word safe or use the word comfortable? Which would you prefer? Like, how would you start that dialogue with the students?
So high school age, that's my favorite age to work with. I love the high school age. I'm very direct when I teach about, like, these language changes. I try to be as direct as possible. So I definitely use the word safety, and whether it's like more comfortable, what would make you feel more comfortable in the room? You can change the wording like that, because maybe they're not able to comprehend what does safety mean to them. You can give them suggestions, or this other student said, he would prefer if you say this, or instead, you know, One thing that happened at the school was people walking behind someone. Like when you're on hyper alert, someone who's gone through trauma, you hear everything, you feel everything, you see everything. Your senses are on hyper alert. If someone is walking behind them, you might want to give them a heads up. Like if they're jumpy a little bit, you might say like, hey, I'm going to be walking behind you in a second. And that helps their brain feel safe. It helps them feel trustworthy. So I'm trying to tick off all of the pillars of trauma-informed care. I'm trying to provide trust, try to provide safety, collaboration. That's collaboration between me and the student saying, how can we work together to make you feel safe? So I would ask little things like that, or, you know, there's kids that are jumpy, there's adults that are jumpy. I'm pretty jumpy myself. I would make sure to have discussions with like the other students in the room, like, hey, make sure you're not dropping books, or like, be careful with your stuff so it's not falling on the floor. And it's little things that you see that you might say, oh, I know that this student gets a little hyper alert or a little startled when something falls or when the door slams. So maybe I would put like a little door stopper in that's a quiet close so that it's not slamming shut every time, or there's a note on the door, whatever you can do to make your room more comfortable or more safe. Little changes like that make a big, big difference.
That's such great advice. Oh my goodness. You can't even think of like the books falling to the ground. Little things like that, like you just don't think of that could really make a student impact them and them feeling safe and secure. And
I'm a person, and I talk about this a lot and on my Instagram, I'm a person with ADHD and now PTSD. And I'm very affected from both of those with noises. Like I can't concentrate very well if there's noises. So I try to make my speech room as noise-free as possible with the door, with anything like even the pulling out of the chairs. Like you all know what it sounds like when you pull a wooden chair. Or even my teeth are hurting just thinking of like the metal on the floor. So I got like, you know, the little things that you buy at Target, the little stoppers, not even the tennis balls. I was like, I'm not buying the tennis balls, but I got the little stoppers, and that was something to make the room less noisy. And I work with students with autism. I work with a lot of kids that have different sensory needs. So it's not just the trauma-informed to be trauma-informed for kids that might have gone through trauma. It's also part of our scope of like, we work with kids with sensory needs, and I'm an adult with sensory needs, and I try to reduce the noise level as much as possible. And just those little changes, whether you think so or not, impact their safety. They feel safe in the room because their sensory input isn't overloaded and you're not putting these tasks on them when they can't pay attention. So little things like that are just easy changes to make to add to the trauma-informed nature.
That's great advice. What advice would you give to someone who maybe didn't put some of these things in place first, and then something happens in their room, book falls, a loud noise, you know, student got caught off guard by someone walking behind them. Something happened that set something in action.
Right.
How would you handle that situation? What would you recommend someone do to rectify or recover from that kind of situation?
These situations are all like, what happens if a book falls, or what happens if this? I would say after something happens that maybe scares a kid or, you know, makes someone feel unsafe, the repair is equally as important as what you are putting in to prevent, right? So the repair would be like, hey, I'm so sorry, that was my bad. That shelf fell and I put it up incorrectly. I'm going to get the janitor to come in, whoever is the maintenance guy, to secure it better so that that way that doesn't happen again. Or just talking with them through it, like, how can we address this better to make sure it doesn't happen again? Or what happens if it does happen again? What coping strategies, like, can we maybe talk about to help us get through that? How would you like us to move forward with this? Also giving students space, time to regulate themselves. I'm big into talking about regulation now, which is just like understanding what your emotions are, understanding what your coping strategies are. So let's say a book falls, a kid gets scared, and then you as the SLP are like, all right, back to work. And you're not giving them any time to like readjust and calibrate and get themselves back to a window of tolerance, which is like the vagus nerve. And I could talk about trauma for hours and hours. We need to give them time and resources to help regulate themselves. So that might be, hey, do you need like 2 minutes to go sit in my calm corner? Which I did have a calm corner. It was just like a very tight corner with a nice cozy chair and like a pillow on the floor. And some kids would just go sit in that dark corner, put in their headphones for 2 minutes and come back and say, all right, I'm ready to work now. You can also say if they're not ready in 2 minutes, how about another 2 minutes? You need another minute. Like the most important thing is their safety and building that relationship, building trust, transparency, everything that we're doing. We need to make sure that academics is not the very first thing that we're doing. One of the things that I present on is like this upside down triangle of you need to have those regulation component fixed. You need to have that relationship before reasoning at the top. So you need to have both of those down before you can get right into the academics. And I think that's where most SLPs mess up is after something happens, we're so quick with whether it's our productivity or the school system or whatever it is that we're bound by that. So we're like, all right, come on, come quickly. Let's go to the next thing. We need to do wait time. We need to practice wait time. Give a little space, let them control themselves a bit better and get the academic brain out and put away their survival brain. And it's not on your timeline, it's on theirs. One example that I give all the time is if you have a student who is in survival brain, so say something scares them and they're in freeze. You guys have heard of fight, flight, freeze, and then there's also fawn. If they're in freeze and their body isn't able to move and you're giving them a countdown, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, I'm an adult who, when I am in freeze, no countdown is going to get me to move. So we're putting these expectations on kids and thinking that it's a behavioral choice when their brain has taken control and is saying, you are not safe, stay still. They can't get out of that. So we need to give some time for them to feel safe, for them to feel trust. And the best way to do this is building relationships. The better relationship that we have with our students, with our clients, the more easily they will feel safe and feel trust. And all of those components, all those pillars of trauma-informed care help us to be the best providers that we can be.
That's true. And I always say connection over data collection.
Yes.
You're not going to get that data if you don't spend the time to make sure you have the connection and your students feel comfortable and willing. They're not going to be willing to take risks and do challenging things if they're not ready.
Right. I think a lot of us are just thinking about ready in what we feel, the timetable that we feel ready should be. And I just think of all the time, all these adults walking around the world dysregulated. Like we see people acting bad all the time, acting in a way we think is inappropriate for a certain situation. We put such heavy demands on children for their behavior, and it's more developmentally appropriate at their age than the adults. We need to give them some room to have mistakes. And the best way to do that is to feel safe and to have trust with that person, which the SLP is absolutely a person who can provide trauma-informed care. Without knowing what they've gone through, it's definitely helpful to know more that you could be more specific to avoid certain things. But at the same time, you shouldn't need to know what they've gone through to be trauma informed.
What are some coping strategies other than like, you know, asking for a break or a common corner? What are some other things that we can incorporate or teach our students to utilize when they need it?
I'm a big believer, and I personally use some breathing strategies. So many of you do work with stuttering, with fluency and everything like that. And that's where I first learned breathing strategies, and then doing yoga and all these other things that I learned breathing strategies. My favorite breathing strategy is called 4-7-8. So that's breathing in for 4 seconds, holding for 7, and then breathing out for 8. And that repetitive thing helps me ground. There is a strategy called grounding, which a lot of times people think that's for people with PTSD, that it's like when you're in a dissociative event that you don't know where you are, which that is a very small percent of people who experience PTSD what a trigger is for them or what a symptom is for them. Very few people experience like they don't know where they are. One of the strategies is grounding, which can be used for anyone. So that would be like, name five things that you see, name four things that you hear, name three that you smell, and you go through all the senses, name one thing that you taste. That helps bring people back to feeling their own body when they feel outside of their body. So some people feel helpful with grounding strategies. There's a ton of breathing strategies out there. I'm also a big believer in fidgets. A couple of years ago, I worked in the school system, and in high school, when fidgets were like a thing with the spinners and everything, that it became like a black market, that it was wild. It was really crazy at the high school level that people were like dealing with fidget spinners and everything. That gave fidgets a bad name. A fidget is like a stimming thing. And I'm a person with ADHD. I stim all the time. I have a thumbtack in my hand that I'm like playing with. And while I wouldn't give that to a child, that's helpful for me right now, apparently. But I have a big mystery box full of, I got it on Amazon. It's just like a mystery pack of a whole bunch of different fidget spinners, but mostly like those poppet things. Mm-hmm. There's like these little tube things. I had a bowl of them in my room for people to use, like to check it out, like a library kind of thing. Oh, what's your fidget today? And I knew what kids were going to go back to the same one. And then they'd go through it and they're like, where's my fidget? Like some kid walked out with it. But that is very self-regulating for people. And I think a lot of us forget that because we were in the schools when that big fidget boom happened. And we think of it as a toy for a lot of people, but it is something that helps me focus. When I'm presenting for 6 hours straight, I'm holding on to something and moving it around. It helps me concentrate and it helps students concentrate. So we need to think that maybe this student would benefit from using a fidget. What fidget might help them the best? Have them explore with it. You can use that as a lesson. Like, tell me everything you know about this one, or tell me the colors here. Tell me what that, like, make it part of your lesson, but also teach them that that might be helpful for them to, whether it's getting through a stressful moment or just to focus. Like, we need to use their strengths to help them. And it's showing that it's a safe environment for them to do that.
Love that you had that little bowl for them, little candy jar of needs. And just, again, making sure not only they can see you as a safe person, but your space is safe because you're giving them all the tools there and allowing them to explore and feel as comfortable as possible. That's just amazing. What advice would you give to someone who it might be getting kickback from administration or just any sort of struggle with getting people on board with trauma-informed care?
There's a lot of research out there. Unfortunately, like in the field of speech, it's been booming the last 5 years. I think COVID was a big amplifier of that I got so many presentation requests last year, and that was like the first year that it was really people were asking, what did we just go through? Why is mental health the way it is now? And what can we do about it? So I would advocate for people to get trained on trauma-informed care, whether it's me, whether it's someone else, whether your district has someone or whatever your setting you're in, you all should be trained in trauma-informed care. The field of speech is extremely behind in trauma-informed care. You can ask anyone. One of my best friends is in accounting. They have been trained on trauma-informed care for the last 20 years. And this is Florida. We are not ahead in anything, you know? So we really are very behind. So we are a field. We're working directly with people. We need to be trauma-informed. Trauma-sensitive is a whole other component of that would be for this person has experienced something traumatic and you go in. So my school, for example, we should have been trained on trauma-informed care before anything happened. After should have been trauma-sensitive training. We should have been trained on that to know exactly, or trauma-specific. We need to know specifically how to best address this specific situation. When the kids that are in front of me might have experienced that as a trauma, they might have had trauma before, and they might have been going through trauma concurrently at home or at school or whatever it is, and continue to have trauma. So we need to be really mindful. We need to be asking our supervisors to get trained in trauma-informed care. we at our level need to be trained, but the people above us also need to be trained. So I'm very passionate about saying all levels above us need to be trauma informed for us to be 100% trauma informed. So one of the examples of that is I work for the school system in Florida. So the government is above me. ASHA is above me. The state association is above me. I cannot be 100% trauma informed because in Florida, we don't have a caseload cap. So my first year in the schools, I had 120 kids. And I thought that that was a normal amount as a CF. I was like, oh, it is what it is. I can't be 100% trauma informed with a caseload like that because I can't build the relationships. I can't ensure the safety. I can't, all of these pillars are not being met. So the systems above me have to fight for trauma informed care within their level to make sure that the people at the bottom are receiving trauma informed care.
Wow, so true. So amazing. Where could people learn more about how to get themselves trauma-informed care and learn more about getting training from you and things like that?
So my website is www.ptsdslp.com. My Instagram is ptsd.slp. The place that I refer to all the time for trauma-informed care is SAMHSA. It's the Substance Abuse Mental Health. I can never remember the last letter. I always mess up on it. But basically, they did a position paper in 2014. Not even a position paper, but a manual on how to be trauma-informed. I refer to that all the time. If you are interested in trauma-informed care as like an intro, what I was telling you about that quote of changing from what's wrong with you to what happened to you, there is a book from Oprah and Dr. Bruce Perry of that name. It's called What Happened to You. I highly recommend the audiobook. It sounds like a conversation and it's a really like nice intro into it when some other books on trauma-informed care are very like brain heavy examples. The one that I just recommended is a much lighter version of a heavy topic. So it's definitely the best place to look.
Thank you. And we'll have links to your everything in the show notes. So not to worry. Definitely everyone go check out Rachel if you want to learn more about trauma-informed care, how to incorporate this practice into your everyday practice and how to advocate for the students and get your higher ups to get you trained and be more informed. Like Rachel said, you can only do so much if those above you are not, you know, getting trained and being aware themselves. So thank you so much, Rachel, for sharing your wisdom, your knowledge, your experience, your expertise, all the research that you've done. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for everyone listening. Hopefully you are walking away with just changing your mindset a little bit on how you can approach things, how you can just be more mindful. And even again, just we can say all the time that I'm safe, but how can we make our environment safe? And we can't assume anything, that it's okay to ask and how to make sure that you're really truly going above and beyond to make sure that students are safe. And the fact that like safety, survival is first over the tally marks and the goals.
100%.
Thank you so, so much. Everyone listening, go to check out Rachel and stay out of trouble. We'll see you next week, everyone.
Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of SLP Coffee Talk. It means the world to me that you're tuning in each and every week and getting the jolt of inspiration you need. You can find all of the links and information mentioned in this episode at my website, speechtimefun.com. Don't forget to follow the show so you don't miss any future episodes. And while you're there, it would mean the world to me if you would take a few seconds and leave me an honest review. See you next week with another episode full of fun and inspiration from one SLP to another. Have fun, guys.